Okay, what mistake do first-time CEOs make the most often? We touched on one, which is firing too slowly. Another is not raising enough money. And then there's the fundamental where I started, which is who is your customer? What problem are you solving for them? Will they pay you to solve that problem? Are there enough of them that you can make money at this, right? Can you solve this at scale and make a profit? That's generic to say, but I've actually seen it go wrong. And so I've worked with companies where they seem to be selling a lot. They're charging for it. They're getting POC after POC, but those aren't actually converting into repeatable clients. Each one's different, and you realize you're never going to make money unless you turn this into a repeatable business. So, that's one. I think other people have said this before too, but I don't want it to sound like I'm saying get the perfect product, because I think some companies, especially engineer-led companies, can tend to spend too much time perfecting the product, right? Go out and start charging for it
Get it out
early.
there.
Get it out there and start charging. But you do have to say, you have to be willing, just you have to be willing to fire a bad employee. At some point, you may have to fire your clients, right? It may not be, it's like, okay, I can't continue serving you this way. This isn't going to work. I'm changing the product.
I
I'm
think you're
leaving.
absolutely right. I have a team of six people that's doing some incredible stuff with machine learning and AI, and they've had this customer that's had them on POC for 9 months. And we had this kind of conversation in the board meeting. I said, when are they going to close? And they're like, next quarter. I was like, oh, guys, at some point, if they don't give you a PO in January, we're done. Like, it's okay to say, look, it's not a good fit.
Exactly.
But
Exactly.
you have so many other good things going on that all this energy in a customer that hasn't closed in the last year is not worth it. But it's
Yep.
hard to let go. From Foundation Capital, this is How to B2B a CEO, the show about how to scale your enterprise startup and how to grow from founder to CEO. I'm Ashu Garg, general partner at Foundation Capital. On this episode of the podcast, I'm joined by Kevin Johnson, CEO of Udemy, a global marketplace for online learning and teaching. Before Udemy, Kevin was the CEO of Ebates, an e-commerce business which Kevin grew 40-fold during his 9-year tenure and sold to Rakuten for $1 billion. We're going to jump right into why Kevin decided to join a company that many others had written off.
I got approached by a recruiter to look at a little dot-com survivor called Ebates.
A foundation company.
A foundation company, which Foundation was an investor way back in the early days in 98. Fast forward to 2008 when I joined, it had survived through the dot-com boom and bust, and that's really what attracted me, the fact that it had survived. I knew there was something there, and the more I looked at it, the more I liked, because I felt it was really a diamond in the rough, and the company at the time still had shoppers, still had members using the site from 1999 when it launched. We're still using it in 2008, and so I joined. It was about a $15 million revenue company and under 40 people. After 6 years, we were getting ready to go public in 2014, and we literally were weeks away from ringing the bell on the New York Stock Exchange when we were approached by Rakuten, the big Japanese e-commerce company, who convinced us to sell to them instead for the psychologically pleasing amount of $1 billion, and also financially pleasing amount. Though we talk about potential mistakes after we sold, we then tripled the business over the next 3 years. So from the outside, people say, wow, that's amazing. You sold a company for a true unicorn, not just on paper, but you really sold it for that. And I said, yes, but how often do you get the chance to take $1 billion company and turn it into a $3 billion company? Which is
And so in hindsight, do you think you sold too soon?
I go back and forth. The nice thing is that obviously my favorite thing in business is a win-win situation. And so we had a happy sellers and a happy acquirer and happy employees, which is great. It doesn't get any better than that.
Absolutely.
Really. Rakuten was a great acquirer. They helped us, they helped us grow, and I had a great time doing it and had, had a great relationship, still have a great relationship with the CEO, Hiroshi Mikitani. So I've really got no complaints there. Now, would I have more money if I'd kept going? Probably so, but it was a great experience.
Yeah. No, but I think the lesson that you're talking about, it's always a hard decision at that point, is I think when you have scale and momentum, and if the trend line continues, there's a lot of value that actually gets created on the back end.
That's right.
It took you, 6 years to create $1 billion of value is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I mean, because Ebates, we had pretty much written it off at the time. I remember. I joined the firm at the same time.
Yeah, I think there was an effort to sell it that I didn't learn about, of course, when they were recruiting me, but I think there was an effort to sell it for, you know, basically $20 million net, and there were no buyers. And I only found out about that later when I'm selling it for $1 billion. So
20 million to $1 billion in 6 years.
Yeah. It's not bad.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But you think it could have been three times that in another 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, the company has continued. I mean, we were really dominating our little industry when we sold, and that's continued even more so. And so I think that is a nice lesson. And if I think back lessons on the way, I mean, one of the hard parts about Ebates is e-commerce was not hot when I joined Ebates. Like now it seems obvious in hindsight, but the whole new wave of e-commerce wasn't happening at that point, right? This was still old. We were still basically in a original dot-com world.
It was a 1.0
world. There were no, you know, we were the first to really come back and successfully advertise on TV as an e-commerce company. This was back before, you know, we're talking about before Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, et cetera. None of that was happening. Wayfair, House, nothing, right? Even Groupon. And so companies came and went during that time. And I had a VC board, of course. And so, you know, one of the challenges is if you've got a decent business, it's staying focused because there's always a shiny new object, especially in San Francisco, right? You can't turn around without bumping into somebody who's got the coolest sounding startup you've ever heard of. And so half of the battle, honestly, was building our business. The other half was just trying to filter out and say no to why, you know, because we literally heard along the way, why aren't you Groupon? It's like, well, because I don't think that model's going to last. And why aren't you the Find? You know, they've got amazing SEO. Why don't you have that? And well, because that SEO arbitrage doesn't necessarily last either. All it takes is an algo change. And so trying to stay, when you're able to buy low and sell high, when you've got a model that works, avoiding the distraction of other shiny objects.
I want to compare and contrast on the culture point, your experience at Udemy and Ebates. So Ebates was a relatively small company.
Ebates was small, small and tired, and had sort of been through this big cycle and was sort of like a little bit treading water. And so it's very different from Udemy. So it was 40 people versus 400 almost when I got here, 350 when I got here. And very different in that I felt at the time at Ebates, I had to come in and get the company to do things like, you know, get people moving and doing new things and doing things differently and being more aggressive on certain things. And so it felt like, and of course, with only 40 people or so, it sort of felt like, you know, I knew everything that was going on and nothing happened without me knowing. Udemy is the other end of the spectrum. And one of the amazing things about this place that I love about it is it's a culture of empowerment. I mean, when I got here, it was 350 people all doing things, right? And so it was a totally
different
things. 300 different. And so I felt like I was just running to keep up and sort of nudge left, nudge right, try to steer all this going on, because you can't take without ruining things. You can't stand up and say, everybody stop, you know, don't do anything until you talk to me about it. And so it's a totally different challenge. And there you're much more trying to manage by setting the priorities, you know, start adjusting the culture and start getting all those people to then start making, they're already taking action. So you're trying to get them to think the right way and think differently as they take those actions. You know, Udemy is a very mission-driven company by
the nature of what you're doing.
By the nature of what we're doing and the people we've attracted along the way. I fully believe, especially at Udemy, but this can happen anywhere, but it's especially here, that there's no conflict between our mission and good business as well. And in fact, being a good marketer means right content, right person, right time. Very similar to education, right? If you're gonna really reach somebody through education, influence their life, it's the same thing. Getting them the right content at the right time in their lives. And so there's not really a conflict between being a good e-commerce company and being an education company at the same time. So helping people understand that and not react like, oh wait, you're talking a lot about revenues. Does that mean you don't care about the mission? No, it means I care about sustaining the mission, and that the revenue is a measure for how many people we're reaching with content that they value, that they're willing to pay for, that allows us to pay our instructors to create more content, to attract more students, and so on and so on. I'd say emphasizing that has been one of the things that I've done here. And again, I get back to that marketplace, the two-sided marketplace, and making sure that we're really understanding. It's natural to understand your students, but making sure that we're also understanding the needs of our instructors and balancing those two things and serving both sides. And so that's one of the things I've focused on as well.
I think that resonates a lot. And, you know, in many ways, the greatest companies are mission-driven, independent of what they do. And as you said, though, to sustain the mission, you need a profitable, viable, and scalable business that can fuel the mission for years and hopefully decades.
That's right.
We'll be right back.
If hiring engineers isn't keeping you up at night, either your company's not growing or you already know about touring. Listeners of this podcast know that finding the right team is critical to the success of your startup, but recruiting in the Valley is time-consuming and expensive. That's why touring exists. Touring helps companies hire remote, Google-caliber engineers at less than half the cost with the push of a button. To clear Turing's engineering bar, developers need to pass a rigorous 40-hour coding challenge. We accept less than 1% of developers who apply. Turing has fully vetted developers today for full stack, front end, back end, iOS, Android, AI, and data science roles. You pay only for hours worked and have the option to scale up on demand. So, if you're ready to hire elite software engineers, go to Turing.com and sign up for our 2-week trial. That's Turing.com. If you don't like the work your engineer has done in the first 2 weeks, pay nothing. Go to Turing.com to double your runway today.
Let's get back to my interview with Kevin Johnson, the CEO of Udemy. In this second part of the conversation, Kevin and I discuss the importance of company values and how to make leadership hires. At this scale, what are some of the biggest challenges you deal with as CEO?
Well, now, I mean, we start to get to how best to organize, right? So we're in the middle of sort of revamping our value statement and trying to come up with the ones that are just the most core and essential, and strip out in our statement, not in what we actually live, but of our statement that we share, strip out the ones that every company, you know, 85% of companies have a value statement, put innovation on there. So it's like, it becomes meaningless. What company isn't trying to be innovative? So we're taking those out and trying to communicate, try to express those that are truly unique
for you and
that really define us.
Define us.
How important are value statements? I'll tell you something that I have seen over and over, because I've acquired a lot of companies along the way. I've worked at a lot of companies as a consultant or directly. I have never seen a company that violates this rule that I've come up with, which is there is an inverse correlation between the degree to which the values are posterized at a company and actually lived at a company. And so I've seen over and over again companies with this, you don't get to be a full employee and pass probation until you can name the 10 values. And then as you demonstrate each one the first time, we'll give you a little sticker for your laptop. Guarantee you that's the company where the CEO is sleeping with somebody and the CFO is embezzling, or, you know, there's an inverse correlation between actually living them and posterizing them. So I think they are important to think about and to share, but actually, like, oh, here's our poster, here's our statement, it's really much more important to live and demonstrate them from the top down.
You know, I couldn't agree more. In fact, you know, I had a portfolio company a couple of years ago that hired a consultant to do values offsites for the entire company. And I remember telling myself, this is the worst possible thing that could happen. And the company was doing really well, so it was hard to tell the CEO, no, this isn't okay. You know, as an investor, you're always trying to decide, where do you intercede and where do you back off? But I remember, you know, just feeling really shitty about that process. And lo and behold, 6 months later, I mean, the company started to fall apart. I mean, every value they had talked about,
they
wasn't
violated.
Real. They were violating, and there was so much backbiting and infighting going on in the leadership team.
Yeah,
and it felt in hindsight that this was all lipstick on a pig.
Yeah,
I've often wondered, are there really, you know, one end of the spectrum to say every company has a unique culture, and so there are as many cultures as there are companies.
Right.
At the other extreme, you could assert that all successful companies at their core actually have the same culture.
Right.
They have a culture of being exceptionally customer focused. They have a culture of getting shit done. And they have a culture of integrity.
Right.
And ethical behavior.
Right.
And everything else is some flavor or wrapper of those three things. And that's an extreme point of view.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to get your sense.
It could be. I think we could probably both very quickly name companies that are worth a heck of a lot of money that haven't had ethical behavior, that hasn't been, that are happily selling data that you don't know you've given, that they fooled you into giving to people that shouldn't have the data. So I do think, unfortunately, it is quite possible to make money and have a successful company without sort of ethics being core. How long it can last, I don't know. And I think, but yes, you've got to understand your customer. You've got to actually get things done to last. But I think within that, there are different values and different flavors and different things that are important that make a company unique. And so I'll take one. I'll just compare.
Please.
So I'll take Apple Computer, right? Very different from other companies, especially while Steve was alive and running it, in terms of how products got developed, right? It was the vision coming down from the genius, and the genius was not to be questioned, right? And there are plenty of other players. It was a very strong culture of
top down.
And in fact, a success off of, they did user research. Nobody wanted an iPod, right? That's not something any customers expressed any need for. That was a vision coming from Steve, right? And then this led to a design culture, and we're going to create beautiful products and then convince people that they need and desire these, right? That's very different from other companies. And I'll take us as Udemy, as we describe our values. We don't have the pithy statement of it yet, but one of our values and one of our quirks is we really are enablers. Our goal is to succeed through your success. We are trying to enable success. It's a core value, right? We're not trying to be the heroic teachers or the heroic students. We're really trying to create a platform for a great teacher to express his knowledge. And for a student, if you want to come learn it, you can learn it. We're not going to, so far, we haven't succeeded by holding your hand and helping you learn or making you a great, we're here to enable your success. And that's very different from being heroic, like, oh, we built the greatest product or have the greatest design. It's a pretty different culture and even what you value and hire for and emphasize.
I think that makes sense. And, the other thing I find is that, we're talking about sort of ethical behavior. I think that's one of those values where what is ethical is very different for different people.
Exactly.
And, I think by and large, people would agree, most companies would say, don't break the law.
Right.
But that's a very low bar.
That's
a very low bar. And so I think that's a fair point. I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about building your leadership team and especially how the leadership team evolves at different stages of growth. Because you've seen companies from 15 million in revenues to many, many hundreds of millions in revenues, both here at Udemy and sort of at Ebates. Yep. So can you talk a little bit about your philosophy on leadership hiring and how that has evolved over time?
I mean, I think there are, the hard part is there are absolutely people who can scale up, right? There are people, and I've had that question before when I've been recruited. Are you a 0 to 5 guy? Are you a 5 to 50 guy or a 50 to 500? It's like, yes.
All of the above,
I hope. Though I think now I've got certain strengths there. I'm probably not a 0 to 5 guy, right? That's probably not my strength. I'm more of the, 50 to a billion or beyond. And I think the short answer is it's tempting just to assume you have to hire somebody who's done this, but there are absolutely people on your team that can scale and that can go from a small revenue amount to a bigger and don't have any limits. Those are the people that, those tend to be people that are always learning, right? They have that mindset. They tend to be data-driven, obviously, to fuel that learning, and they're constantly trying to improve. And then there are people that can do it, but don't particularly want to, right? Because it is what happens. I mean, the hardest part for any company and any manager is getting beyond that stage where you know everything that's going on and where you're influencing every decision, right? When you have to, as a leader of a company, going from that, I can't remember what the name is, the number, it's, what is it, 120 or 160, the theory where
you no longer know everyone.
No longer know everyone, and it's similar. You no longer know everything that's in the release, every initiative that's being worked on, every client that's being sold. And so the hard part is starting to manage through others, and the hardest of all is managing through influence, right? When you no longer get to tell people what to do and have control, but you're just trying to influence that person over there to.
And how do you deal with that transition? Because it's a crucial transition.
Yeah.
Where to some point in a company as a CEO, you have the data.
Right.
And you may have a more dictatorial top-down approach, a la Apple, or you may have more of a persuasive approach.
Yep.
But either way, you have an answer in mind.
Yeah.
At some point, for most companies and most CEOs, the business has become sufficiently complex
right.
that you don't actually know what the right answer is.
Right.
You have to nudge folks in the right direction.
Yeah. It's not comfortable. You just have to, I think, in terms of if you know the answer, you have to pick your battles. And I have consciously along the way, and you have to do this if you're going to develop people. And it's easier, obviously, if you're sort of along the way as you're growing. I have actually had that very moment where I thought, okay, I know the answer. So-and-so, you know, doesn't know the answer, has the wrong answer. I'm going to let him or her make the mistake. You know, like, give the advice, watch them make the mistake, and let them learn from it, rather than come in and say, no, it's not that. You have to do this. Now, of course, there are guardrails, and you can't bet the whole company on that, so you're always trying to figure out, you know.
I know the feeling. As a board member, so many times you see a first-time founder, CEO, yeah. you know, make a decision. You're like, I've seen this a few times.
Yeah, I know
they're
what's going
to hit a brick wall, and yet the right answer is to let them hit the brick wall.
Yeah.
Hopefully not at 100 miles an hour, but
exactly.
at 20 miles an hour.
Exactly.
So it's an accident and not a yep. fiasco.
And I think for some people, like I actually had someone come to me. It was great. It was I'd been a CEO, and then I went to running a big chunk of the organization at a much larger company. And I was really frustrated over some decisions that were being made, and they were not in my control. And a guy who'd been around a little bit longer came to me and said, this is where you have to manage through influence. And I was like, what? That's a thing? That sucks. You have to do that? How do I do? And so he just taught, like, this is the reality, and coached me through it. And I listened, thank God, because sure enough, he was right. And I had to, and that's all he did. He had no direct reports. He was an influencer. He was kind of a fellow within the organization. So he gave me great advice, and I watched him and how he did it. And I didn't copy it, and I couldn't do what he does. But I learned what I needed to learn to exert
in your own
that,
way,
in
too.
My own way, to exert that kind of influence across the organization. And so I try to keep that in mind and look for it on my team to go coach somebody at that. I hope I can have that kind of influence on somebody at that right moment and say, oh, guess what? This is the time you need to influence.
So I want to come back to hiring leaders one more time. Yep. You know, you've hired so many leaders over time. Are there some patterns in terms of things that have worked for you? Is there advice you have for CEOs who are hiring executives for the first time? I mean, it could be as tactical as what questions to ask.
Yeah. It's hard. The best thing, of course, is hire people you know and trust. That's the surefire way. So I will come at one is trust is paramount, and I definitely believe somebody has a phrase, this operating at the speed of trust, and I think that is critical. If there's any sort of untrustworthiness of motives or what somebody wants to do, or you know, you just cannot make it work. The second thing to look for in hiring a leader is look for someone that people have followed. Right? If you're hiring someone who as a leader in your organization and they don't bring people with them, or they can't give you references of people that followed them across a couple companies, you should be worried. That's the surest sign that they're a good leader that people
Absolutely.
Will follow. The third piece of advice, just generic advice that I'm shocked by, is the number of people who don't do their own reference checks. Just a classic
one. We've heard that a few times in the podcast.
Yeah.
You know, just back channel reference checks is the most important thing.
Front and back. I use top recruiters sometimes to hire people, and they'll say to me, so we're just going to do the reference. I'm like, no, you're not doing the references. You have no interest in finding the bad stuff. You're trying to get a fee for me, you know, hiring this person. And B, like, more importantly, even if you manage to avoid that conflict that you have, I'm not going to get the information that I need on how to make this person successful. And so do the references yourself. And when you do those references, you should go into them not thinking, tell me what's great about the person, or even tell me what's wrong with the person. If you're meeting somebody, you're hiring them, you should, by the time you get to that point, you should know what you think they're going to be good at, and you should know where you have concerns, like where you think I'm going to help them, where might they not be a fit on the role or the organization. That's what you should be focusing on, that, going out and asking and validating, is this I have uncertainty here. Do they alleviate my concern, or do they escalate my concern? You should have a very specific set of things you want to learn in those reference calls. beyond that, it all depends on the role.
So one of the things I've seen that, you know, one of my CEOs sort of had this philosophy that every person, every executive in particular that they hired, you know, they would give them 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. And if 8 weeks later they didn't feel better about the person than they did when they hired them,
they were out. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't have an 8 week rule, but I was going to say the next mistake I think new CEOs or new managers make is firing too slowly. I've asked this question every time I know someone who struggled with firing somebody. Afterwards, I say, okay, now you've fired them. Do you wish you'd waited? And nobody ever says, yes, I wish I'd waited 6 more months. Every time it's, I wish I'd done that earlier, right? And so it's almost, my corollary of the 8 week rule is, almost the minute you think maybe this isn't the right person, you already know the answer. Yeah. That isn't the right person. So it's, yes.
It's almost always 6 months too late. And I've made that mistake more than a few times.
Yeah. It's hard. It's very hard. And it's hard to admit mistakes. And the other thing I'll say about hiring is in certain roles, even, you know, the best hirers and the best recruiters, you may only get it right 50% of the time is the truth, especially you focus on B2B, like you hire an enterprise salesperson, enterprise sales leader, like their job is to convince you to hire them, right? And, you know, there's a good chance you'll get it wrong. They won't be the right person.
Absolutely. I think even the average salesperson is great at selling themselves.
Exactly.
It's the challenge. So I want to come back to sort of another aspect of hiring, you know, which is this balance between hiring for potential or versus hiring for someone that can do the job today,
right,
and will be the best at the job over the next 12 to 18 months. As you hire executives on the team, how do you think about that trade-off?
I tend to hire for today, I would say, but obviously you want people who can grow with the role. But I think the challenge is if you're hiring for the future, then they're going to be frustrated today. You know, you're going to spend 18 months with them frustrated. Like I'll just use it. Silly example, but if you're hiring a broadcast marketer TV person and you're not going to have TV budget for 2 years, then they're going to spend 2 years mad at you, right? And not adding value and thinking about how if that's their thing and you know you need to get there, well, wait until you're a little bit closer. I'd say, largely speaking, try to hire people who can do the job but have upside.
Yeah, well, I think well said. Well, Kevin, thank you very much for joining us today in the podcast. This has been a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it.
That's it for this episode. You can find past episodes and subscribe to future ones on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. How to B2B a CEO is brought to you by Foundation Capital, an early-stage venture capital firm with 27 IPOs, including Netflix, Lending Club, TubeMogul, and Sunrun. I'm Arshu Garg, a general partner at Foundation Capital. I'm passionate about helping B2B entrepreneurs who are trying to solve hard problems. So if this podcast speaks to you, if you are interested in growing from a technical founder into a business leader, drop me a line. Thanks, and see you next time.